MD, RadioMD.com.
He's a cardiologist. He's a chef. He's America's culinary interventionalist. It's time for Code Delicious with Dr. Michael Fenster.
Hey, Food Nation, Healthy Nation, you are listening to Code Delicious. I am Dr. Mike, and we are coming to you live from the University of Montana Innovators and Trailblazers Symposium. We are talking with Dr. Michael Cavanaugh. He's the director for the Center for Structural and Functional Neuroscience at the University of Montana. He started his undergraduate work at Washington University, located, of course, not in Washington, but in St. Louis. And then he went on to Oregon for his PhD, did some postdoc work at the Volum Institute at the Oregon Health Sciences University, joined the faculty there, and has been here at the University of Montana for over a decade, where he not only directs the Center for Structural and Functional Neuroscience, but teaches to graduate undergraduate students, and in his spare time does a little NIH-funded research. And I'm sure filling out those grants is, it doesn't take any time at all, does it, Professor?
No, it's just an afterthought.
So we are talking and getting a little bit of insight into this food taste, smell, connection. And one of the really, you know, fascinating things for me, and we had been talking previously on a lot of the similarities between, you know, what we see in terms of maybe programmed behavior from animals in terms of going out, eating, you know, acquiring food, and some of the differences in humans, even though it seems like the wiring is split a little bit. So we have our taste and smell receptors that go directly to our primitive part of our brain, into the memory limbic system. But there's got to be some kind of connection there with the frontal cortex for those of us that have a functioning one.
Yeah, that's definitely true. So we do have frontal cortical processing that occurs when we eat something, when we taste something, and that helps us recognize what it is we're tasting, and that works by very complex processes. You know, we have many different receptors in our palate, close to 100 different kinds of receptors, and the way we understand what it is we're eating.
Well, I'm going to back up a second there, because that's fascinating. Because kids, you know, are often taught, and people walk around and say, oh, we have four basic tastes, sour, sweet, salty, bitter. You say over 100 different receptors?
Well, that's kind of been historically the idea, that we had four basic tastes, salty, sour, bitter, and sweet. And over the past decade or so, another taste has been now recognized, and the receptor for it has been identified, and that's called umami. And that's the taste that we associate with savory food. And everyone's familiar with the taste of MSG, monosodium glutamate. And it's actually the glutamate, it's actually a form of glutamate receptor in our tongue that mediates that taste.
And I'm going to share a little culinary insight here, because as a chef, as a culinary person, we're always talking about, ooh, we want that umami, which is a Japanese word for savory, flavor. And a lot of that, for example, the glutamates are found in soy sauce. They're found in Worcestershire sauce, if you could say that right. But tomato paste is another one. And many people often wonder why when we cook, we add something like a little anchovy paste to the dish, even though you're not really looking for a fish flavor anchovy, and it's because they're rich in these glutamates. And one of the things that I've come across that I think is fascinating is that, and would you say this is the umami receptor, is that we actually have a taste receptor for fat. Is that umami, or is that something that's a little bit different? I know that we have some receptors, for example, for when we taste the free fatty acids. It's very unpleasant on the tongue, and people forget that, you know, we often talk about taste as being only positive, but from a survival aspect, you want to spit out things that are not good for you.
Right, right. Yeah, there are different sets of receptors that can detect things that are not good for us. The bitter receptors are actually, they're made up of a large family of receptors. There's about 50 in humans. And so that gives us a really broad range of taste receptors that let us recognize lots of different foreign molecules that are, in many cases, not good for us. And that's obviously evolutionarily valuable to us to recognize, you know, bitter flavors when we eat a plant that we find in the forest that turns out to be poisonous.
Or the ability to recognize something that looks good but is spoiled and full of something that's not good. And all these taste receptors, of course, leads me to one of my favorite words. And you know the German a little better than me, so Geschmackstreifen. So this well of taste receptors, again, people think, oh, they're tasting only with their tongue. This is actually located between the hard and soft palate, and it's very rich in taste. So is this kind of a bridge area between taste and smell? Because, again, as a chef, you know, hold somebody's nose, they don't taste so well.
Yeah, there are a lot of interesting and still not all that well understood connections between olfactory system and gustatory system. And when we taste, when we eat food, we enjoy the smell and as well as the taste, as you know. And those sensory inputs combine and let us experience a different experience when we're eating something. The odorant receptors in our olfactory epithelium and throughout in our nose make up a very large gene family, and in fact there are hundreds of those receptors in humans and that are functional, and even more in animals like mice and dogs that depend more on their olfactory system to navigate in the world and recognize what they can eat.
And I'm gonna ask a really sort of basic question, so you could chuckle if you want, but does taste and smell, are they different in the brain, or do they go to the same spot in the brain? Do they function tandemly, or are they discrete and defined?
That's a really interesting question.
It wasn't a totally
dumb question at all. It's actually a question that a lot of neuroscientists are interested in. And it gets to first answer your question directly, there are two different centers in the cortex that handle these inputs from the olfactory system and the taste system and the tongue. But there's a lot of overlap at the same time, and there's processing that occurs in the brain. And in fact, one of the important concept in neuroscience is broad tuning and population coding. And what those words mean essentially they describe functions that our sensory neurons have that let them respond to a number of different stimuli, and many different kinds of neurons have different tuning. And one might be tuned, for example, to recognize a chemical found in banana, and another might be tuned to recognize a sugar. And alone, either of those might not be able to recognize or allow you to perceive the fact that you're eating a banana. But together, when both those neurons are activated and that sensory information is going to your cortex, that allows you to understand and consciously perceive the fact that you're eating a banana. So there's kind of this cooperative population activity of neurons that we use to extract information about our environment.
And then that has to be related somehow to the memory to recall that, hey, I'm eating a banana, because we often talk about, well, you know, how would you describe a banana to someone who's never eaten a banana? That frame of reference just isn't there.
Right. And just like all of our sensory systems, there are connections with memory, and so we remember, and we might have associations that cause us to really like bananas. We could conversely have associations that might make us really avoid bananas, and they might be like experiences that were unpleasant to us for some reason that happened when we ate a banana, and that might lead us to in the future not like bananas, even though we might not understand why that is. There's an association that occurred in our cortex.
Well, that's very interesting, because, you know, I often think that, you know, you see sort of young kids and parents will take them through the drive-in, the fast food, and say, well, I'm going to make you eat healthy, and we're going to get you the side salad instead of the fries. Well, they get a side salad, but it tastes absolutely awful because the tomatoes aren't ripe. The lettuce was picked 3 weeks ago. You know, the carrots are dried. And you eat this and you say, yuck, this really tastes good. And then you ingrain this negative memory of a food experience with a salad of something that really isn't a salad at all.
Yeah, right. And those kind of memories that are ingrained in us, that are associated with our experiences while we're eating, really do have a kind of a special strength that persists in life. And I think an interesting example of that that is a famous example in literature is Proust's book, Remembrances of Things Past, where he talks about his experience as an adult going back and visiting his aunt, who gives him a cookie, a madeleine, and some tea. And when he eats the cookie and drinks the tea, he suddenly has this really powerful experience that of his childhood and the time he spent in the country, in his country home, when he ate the madeleine
And what's really fascinating about that story is before, when he sat down, he was like near suicidal. He was pretty depressed. He's like, you know, this is a bummer of a day. And then he has the madeleine soaked with the tea, and he's like, I feel great. And then he takes another. He's like, well, is it the food? You know, is it a little sugar, a little caffeine? Hey, I'm feeling pretty good. Is it a chemical effect? And then he says, you know, the second one, I wasn't quite. And the third. And then by the fourth, it had kind of worn off. So it clearly wasn't a dose response to sugar, caffeine, et cetera. And we'll talk about maybe some dose response curves in a minute. The pleasure principle, in effect. But how does that work? You know, do we know how that works? Because that is so powerful in shaping, you know, how people eat in this country and really around the world.
Yeah, it's really kind of amazing. When he wrote that book around the turn of the century, there wasn't really very much known about the mechanism, the molecular mechanisms of learning and memory. And he actually, in those passages, the famous passages, he really laid out a lot about the whole idea of associative memory. And really interesting. Now we can go back with what we know now and make sense of a lot of things that are very famous in literature and in science, like Pavlov's dog that you mentioned. We do know a lot, quite a bit more about the cellular and molecular mechanisms of memory and what happens in the brain when a memory is formed and how that can last for as long as our entire lifetime in some cases.
And I think one of the powerful points I kind of got from that is that at first it wasn't a conscious memory. He just felt the emotional response, you know, from that without consciously remembering. And that's a powerful driver, because in this country, because we don't have to just eat for nutrition, for sustenance, we have the luxury of dining for pleasure, and we can get something to eat 24/7, 365. And so these unconscious drivers can push us one way or to the other in making our food choices. And it seems when you really dig down, a lot of these food choices are made on past food experiences and the memories and these associations that then can sort of be manipulated a little bit. What's your thought on that? And if so, do you have to consciously be aware of that to break negative eating patterns that are associated with that?
Yeah, I think those are really good questions. And I think there's a lot we really don't understand, even though everyone's very cognizant of these ideas of things like comfort food that we go back to. And sometimes that we can develop habits that are destructive because we get some kind of reinforcement from eating foods that are not healthy. And then we do have to kind of address that by behavior modifications and figuring out how to break that connection.
So we've got a question from the audience. Go ahead. So the question is sort of about, and to phrase it, it'd be like, how do we get an acquired taste? So maybe something like a coffee or beer or wine, something that we enjoy so much maybe as we age, you know, initially, as she said, you know, doesn't taste that great. So how do we acquire that taste? Or are our tastes and our neurons actually changing as we get older?
Yeah, that's a great question. As far as we know, there's no change as we get older in the actual molecular composition of the receptors and the neurons in our palate that recognize those different molecules. And in something like wine or beer, that's an acquired taste that we really might just not like at all when we're little, we come to enjoy when we're older. It's not because we're getting new receptors or new neurons. It's that there's a plasticity that's occurring at higher levels in the brain, and the way we process that those sensory, the sensory information from our tongue and the way it's processed in our neocortex changes. Just like we develop different likings, we develop, we like to think that as we get older, we're better judges and we have some kind of wisdom. That reflects the fact that our brains are inherently plastic. And as far as we understand, the similar kind of mechanisms occur when we change our what we like.
So by plasticity, what exactly do you mean? Because you don't literally mean we're plastic. I saw the 3D, printers in there. And it's like, well, if I could just go print myself a new cranium, that might work out pretty well. I can make myself a little smarter.
Yeah. We could all use a few extra neurons. But plasticity is a term that's very widely used in neuroscience, and it reflects the fact that there are changeable connections between neurons and the way we consciously perceive the world. We, as far as we can understand now, and I should say, one of the big questions in neuroscience is, what is consciousness? How does it work? And no one has the answer to that question. It's an immensely complex question. But as far as we understand, our conscious perception of the world involves connections between neurons, and our memories involve changes in the connections between neurons that might be long-lasting changes, and typically those are changes that increase the strength of signaling between neurons. And if we're exposed to something that has an impact on us that we end up remembering, that reflects the fact that the synaptic connections between neurons in that circuit, in that sensory circuit that goes from our tongue or wherever all the way up to our cortex, those synaptic connections are strengthened in a process called long-term potentiation. And that all comes under the rubric of plasticity.
So is the brain, in essence, sort of rewiring these connections? Or once a neuron-to-neuron connection is formed, is that a marriage till death do them part?
Both those things happen. As we experience different kinds of sensory perceptions, we can develop new connections, and we can also strengthen existing connections. And during development and during the process, for example, going from infancy to childhood, we're pruning synaptic connections, and lots of connections are actually, as we go from infancy to childhood, we're losing more synaptic connections than we're gaining. And then as we reach a certain age, there's more of a stabilization of the synaptic connections. But even at that point, as we continue to age, we get new connections and we change the strength of the existing connections.
So it's kind of our brains are in evolution, so to speak, as we grow in age. Is that fair?
Yeah. And as we learn more about this whole phenomenon of neural plasticity, it's becoming more and more apparent in the field of neuroscience that that's a fundamental function of our nervous system, is to have this synaptic plasticity.
Well, that is absolutely incredible. And we're going to be talking more food, brain, taste, and smell when we get back from the other side of this break.